Hello, this is Susan at the Talking Information Center. I am reading Fortune Magazine. Today is Thursday, April 9th, 2026. This first story is from the special issue, the 44th annual Forbes 400 of Forbes Magazine. First, family fortunes. Donald Trump just had the most lucrative year of his life, but percentage-wise, his immediate family has done even better. Jimmy Carter's brother, Billy, promoted Billy Beer and took cash from the Libyans. Richard Nixon had his brother Donald's phone tapped amid concerns about business dealings. The United States has a long history of presidential relatives looking to cash in on their connections to the commander-in-chief. But no president or extended family has used the office to profit as successfully as the Trumps. Family members who never had significant fortunes, Eric, Don Jr., Barron, and Melania, have accumulated tens, then hundreds of millions of dollars over the last 12 months, boosting the Trump family fortune to nearly $10 billion. Their primary vehicle for enrichment? Cryptocurrency. Teaming up with his three sons, Donald Trump announced a crypto venture in September 2024 named World Liberty Financial, which initially struggled to gain traction. Then he won the White House. After the election, crypto entrepreneur Justin Sun, whom Joe Biden's Securities and Exchange Commission had accused of fraud the previous year, invested $75 million in World Liberty Financial, routing an estimated $40 million to the president-elect and $16 million more to his family members, kickstarting a powerful engine. In January, days before re-entering the White House, Donald and Melania Trump each launched separate meme coins, handing the couple hundreds of millions of dollars. Once in office, Trump rolled back regulatory enforcement of crypto and signed legislation favorable to the industry, ensuring he and his family would personally benefit. His meme coins, initially tied up for 3 months, now unlock daily, freeing tens of millions per week. World Liberty Financial, meanwhile, has continued selling tokens largely to anonymous buyers, generating an estimated $1.4 billion so far. A Trump family entity receives a roughly 75% cut of those sales, amounting to more than $1 billion. Outside of the cryptoverse, Trump has deployed his cash conservatively. He paid off $114 million of debt against 40 Wall Street, a troubled New York skyscraper, at the start of the summer. In July, he knocked out a couple of smaller loans totaling some $15 million against mansions in New York and Florida. He also loaded up on municipal and corporate bonds. Trump's balance sheet is now stronger than ever, with an estimated $1.1 billion of liabilities and $8.4 billion of assets, $1.1 billion of which are in liquid holdings. Almost everything in his portfolio is doing well. Trump's real estate licensing business, stalled out for years, has come roaring back to life, with new deals in Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, Romania, India, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Its revenue jumped an estimated 580% in 2024 to $45 million, boosting the value of the business by $400 million. In the United States, the president's golf and club portfolio continues to thrive as profits rose an estimated 30% last year, adding about $325 million to Trump's net worth. Appellate judges in New York threw out a roughly $500 million fraud penalty in August. With so much money coming in, the Trumps may soon get back to their first love, building. They have been making noise for years about constructing small villages at their golf resorts in Scotland and Florida. Projects like that require a lot of liquidity, something they haven't always had. But now, after reclaiming the White House and cashing in on the power that comes with it, the Trumps can pretty much do anything they want. Donald's dynasty. President Trump's dad, Fred, got rich building 20,000 apartments across New York City. Donald joined Fred's firm in 1968. From the outset, he was ruthless. His first quote in the inaugural Forbes 400 from 1982, when he and his father were listed together, worth a combined $200 million, $660 million in today's money. Man is the most vicious of animals, and life is a series of battles ending in victory or defeat. Decades later, his family is still monetizing those killer instincts. Donald and Melania. Net worths $7.3 billion and $20 million. Trump's fortune jumped $3 billion in 1 year. That 70% gain was vaulted him 118 spots on the Forbes 400, where he lands this year at number 201. His move into crypto for $2 billion split more or less evenly between World Liberty Financial and the meme coin. A New York appeals court gave him a $500 million boost by throwing out his civil fraud penalty, and another $400 million comes from the explosion of his international licensing business. Melania has made money in typical First Lady ways, books, speeches, a documentary, and unquestionably Trumpian ways, launching a meme coin of her own, which has a current market cap of $50 million. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, $1 billion and $100 million. In January 2021, the same month his father-in-law first left the White House, Kushner founded private equity firm Affinity Partners. Leveraging the relationships he'd built as a presidential advisor, Kushner raised $4.6 billion from backers in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, and has invested more than $2 billion in 22 companies. The firm is valued at an estimated $215 million, thanks in part to Affinity's war chest, plus his 20% stake in his family's real estate firm, Kushner Companies. Kushner is now a billionaire. It also helps that the value of the couple's home on Miami's elite Indian Creek Island, where the neighbors include Jeff Bezos, has more than tripled in value since they bought it in 2020. Donald Trump Jr., $500 million. Don Jr. holds a smaller stake in American Bitcoin and serves as a co-founder of World Liberty. He and Eric set up a special purpose acquisition corporation in August that's on the hunt for merger targets in tech, healthcare, or logistics. He's also a big player in the anti-woke economy, partnering with self-described anti-ESG venture firm 1789 Capital and holding board seats at anti-woke, anti-abortion online marketplace Public Square, online firearm retailer Grab a Gun, and Truth Social's parent company. Eric Trump, $800 million. The president's second son has made more money on crypto than any of his siblings. Most of it comes from American Bitcoin, a crypto mining venture he co-founded in March 2025 that went public in early September, briefly making him a billionaire. Some of the hype has faded, but Eric's 7.5% stake is still worth an estimated $550 million. He also got an estimated 10% cut of World Liberty Financial token sales. With his older brother, Don Jr., he traveled to the Middle East in May, where he signed a deal to license the family name on a golf resort in Qatar, among other new ventures. As of July 2024, the brothers apparently split 20% of the profits from certain licensing deals. Barron Trump, $150 million. The president's youngest child was all in on crypto long before his dad and helped coax the family to co-found World Liberty Financial. He's got four wallets or something, and I'm saying, what is a wallet? Trump chuckled last September at World Liberty's launch. So far, the 19-year-old NYU sophomore has pocketed an estimated $80 million from token sales and still holds an estimated 2.3 billion locked up tokens, which Forbes heavily discounts because they can't yet be traded. If the current price hangs on long enough, he might be able to dump them for $450 million when they unlock. Continuing from the same issue, Zone Offense, with a combination of cash incentives, stock options, and aggressive financial engineering, AutoZone made a billionaire out of its founder and millionaires of thousands of its employees. But can one of the top stocks of the last three decades keep it up in the face of new rivals and fewer gearheads? Phil Danielle was working for a competing auto parts chain when AutoZone entered the Jacksonville, Florida market in 1986. Danielle had worked in car stores since high school, paying his way through college by stocking shelves. He joined AutoZone in 1993 as a store manager in training before being given his own store after a few months, the first of 10 titles in 3 decades. I'm not a phenomenon. If you look at our leadership team, many of our VPs started out in an hourly role at a store, says Danielle, 56, who is now CEO of AutoZone. Today, AutoZone, known for its universal Get in the Zone AutoZone radio jingle, employs 126,000 people with over 6,500 stores in the United States and another 1,000 in Mexico and Brazil. The retailer sells everything from motor oil and upholstery cleaner to specialized car parts for nearly every make and model. With $18.5 billion in sales last year, it is worth about $70 billion. In the last 20 years, its shares have returned an average of 21% annually, trouncing the S&P 500's 11% average return. AutoZone has generated 9-figure-plus windfalls for its original private equity sponsor, KKR, hedge fund billionaire Eddie Lampert, and its founder, Pitt Hyde, who stepped down as CEO in 1996. I wish I had never diversified. That was a huge mistake, jokes Hyde, 82, who is worth around $2 billion today. He sold most of his AutoZone stock back in the 90s. Had he kept it, he'd be worth over $10 billion. But it's not just AutoZone's investors and top brass who have gotten rich, and that is the company's real secret sauce. With a compensation system built around stock options, the retailer has made many of its rank and file wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. More than 4,000 AutoZone employees, including many like Danielle, who began as hourly employees or store managers in the 1980s and 90s, have become millionaires from their AutoZone stock, Hyde says. Our compensation structure is one of the key elements of our success, says Bill Rhodes, chair president from 2005 to 2023. There are very, very few companies that are still 100% stock options in their long-term incentives. That's what we are with our senior leadership team. Following a 2006 accounting rule change requiring companies to record options as expenses on their income statement, many S&P 500 companies have favored compensation packages with restricted and performance-based stock over stock options. But AutoZone stayed the course and has granted options awards to eligible employees every year for the past 25 years, equal to 0.9% of its total shares outstanding. Executives can also elect to take 25% of their annual compensation in AutoZone stock. Our people want the risk. They want the leverage that comes with stock options, says Rhodes, who has netted over $500 million exercising options and selling the stock before taxes. As it's grown, AutoZone has restricted eligibility of stock options awards to about 400 higher-level employees, down from over 38,000 in the late 90s. Today, store managers who drive AutoZone's retail sales are incentivized with cash bonuses based on sales quotas. Store hands are supposed to ask people if they need help within 30 seconds of a customer walking into the store. They perform routine maintenance like changing batteries or installing wipers at no cost and on site. Hit your targets and drive sales and you'll be compensated for it. Or better yet, one day you may end up in corporate, which means stock options, whose value only seems to go up. Employees can also buy up to $15,000 in AutoZone stock annually at a 15% discount to market price through an employee stock purchase plan. The idea is to keep the sales force aligned, invested in AutoZone's future, and motivated to sell, sell, sell. At corporate, the mantra has been buy, 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 back its own stock. AutoZone has purchased $38 billion of its shares since 1998 through May 2025, reducing its outstanding share count by over 90% from over 152 million to 16.7 million as of June. 1998 is also when it started limiting stock options. The company has bought back more shares over time than it originally had outstanding. How is that mathematically possible? It's because of the dilution from all those stock options the company awards. The model has proven durable thanks to AutoZone's earnings moving in only one direction. Since 1987, revenue has increased every year, growing 11.5% annually, while operating income, $3.3 billion last year, and net income, $2.6 billion last year, have increased in all but 3 years. The company has been disciplined in its capital expenditure, opting for slow and steady earnings growth over breakneck expansion. It helps that the auto parts industry cruises through recessions as cash-strapped drivers opt to fix rather than replace their cars. If you put financial engineering on top of a bad business, you're just going to go out of business faster, Rhodes says. If you have a really good business, putting financial engineering on top of that can optimize performance, or as I sometimes like to say, put it on steroids. But to keep its well-oiled machine chugging, AutoZone needs to keep growing. It holds $9 billion in long-term debt on which it must pay interest, $450 million last year, and it has accelerated share repurchases, averaging $3.6 billion in annual share buybacks from 2021 through 2024, compared to an average of $1.2 billion in buybacks the previous decade. Its biggest headaches are macro headwinds. For one, its beloved do-it-yourself customer, the fixer-up guy who comes into the local AutoZone store to be charmed by a motivated salesman, is a bit of a dying breed, says Philip Blee, a consumer equity analyst at William Blair. In 1990, over half of Americans identified as car DIYers, but today DIYers account for only a fifth of the total $400 billion automotive aftermarket. Not only have parts gotten more expensive, cutting into the value proposition, but cars have become harder to repair as they have become more complex and computerized. AutoZone also faces growing competition for the die-hard do-it-yourselfers from the likes of Walmart, Costco, and Amazon. The big-box retailers are some of the more near-term threats, Blee says. AutoZone increasingly sells directly to repair shops, both independent and national chains, a market that now accounts for an estimated 75% of the entire industry and 90% of its growth, according to William Blair. In this space, where customer service is less about face-to-face salesmanship and more about delivering parts faster than anyone else, its biggest rival, O'Reilly Auto Parts, has raced ahead, generating $7.8 billion last year from commercial sales compared to AutoZone's $5.9 billion. Danielle sees that not as a failure, but as an opportunity. He says AutoZone is beefing up its distribution network with new mega hubs that hold over 100,000 unique car parts for nearly any vehicle, from your sister's new Toyota Camry to your neighbor's beat-up Chevy Corvette. We've worked on our strategy of expanding our supply chain. We've run it too tight before, says the CEO, who ran the commercial business from 2015 to 2021. And AutoZone isn't loosening its grip on do-it-yourselfers. It's just looking for them in different places. The chain plans to open 500 new stores in 2028, up from the 190 it has averaged the last 5 years, 200 of them in Mexico and Brazil. AutoZone is nothing if not adaptable. Joseph Pitt Hyde III founded the company, then called Auto Shack, in 1979 after seeing the writing on the wall for his family business, Memphis, Tennessee-based Malone and Hyde, which sold groceries to independent mom-and-pop grocery stores and small chains in the South. He watched as Walmart, on whose board he sat from 1978 to 1983, gobbled up his market share. His idea was to take Walmart's retailer-distributor model, combine it with a shiny supermarket aesthetic, and bring it to a smaller industry with fatter margins. Auto parts, which combined fixed prices, inelastic demand, and no clear national brand, struck him as a clear winner. He researched the industry for a year before opening his first store in Forest City, Arkansas. Within 5 years, he had 170 stores. I learned so much from Sam Walton about his whole productivity cycle, Hyde recalls. He was growing rapidly, and as he leveraged his central overhead, he gained buying power. Rather than putting it on the bottom line, he reflected it in lower prices, and that's what we instituted at AutoZone. Clear-eyed about the trajectory of his two businesses' futures, Hyde took Malone and Hyde private with KKR in 1984 and spun out AutoZone, renamed after a lawsuit by Radio Shack 2 years later. It was really modeled after Walmart. Low prices, great customer service, a good old-fashioned way of doing things, says George Roberts, KKR's billionaire co-founder, which made $2.3 billion on its AutoZone stake. Hyde stepped down as CEO and board chair in 1996 after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. Hedge fund billionaire Eddie Lampert, best known for merging Sears with Kmart, built a 30% stake in AutoZone between 1998 and 2001 and came to its board with ideas, including the share buyback program. He pitched for us to change our capital allocation, recalls Rhodes, who was then SVP of finance. We've continued to use that over the years, and it's gotten bigger and bigger. AutoZone's smartest bet was its $57 million acquisition in 1996 of vehicle diagnostics database AllData, which employees use constantly to identify the exact car part any given customer needs and how much it will cost. As AutoZone enters its next chapter, Danielle is determined to uphold what made it so successful and so rewarding. Our culture has modified and morphed a little bit, but the primary tenets are the same, he says. If you're committed to the industry and committed to the culture, you can do anything at this company. If AutoZone can keep its stock market magic alive and its flock faithful, he just might be right. Not rich enough. With the price of admission higher than ever, a record 500 American billionaires are simply too poor to make the Forbes 400. Those who came up short of the $3.8 billion required include 13 members of the 2024 list who are just as rich or richer than last year, but still lost their spot to someone wealthier, 13 whose fortunes fell, and scores of new billionaires who just haven't amassed enough yet. Another 10 members of last year's list died. Some of those not on the list. Daniela Amode, net worth $3.7 billion. Amode is president of the AI firm Anthropic, creator of chatbot Claude, which she runs with her brother Dario, who is CEO. The pair and five others co-founded the firm in 2021. It raised $13 billion in September at a $183 billion valuation, up from $61.5 billion in March, tripling all seven co-founders' net worths. Amode, an English lit major at the University of California, Santa Cruz, joined financial tech company Stripe in 2013 as a founding recruiter. She later worked as an engineering manager at OpenAI. Safra Catz, net worth $2.9 billion. Few are benefiting from AI hysteria like Katz, who is CEO of software giant Oracle. Shares of the company, which now has contracts with OpenAI, xAI, and NVIDIA, are up 60% in the past year, adding nearly $1 billion to her fortune. The Israel-born Katz, who worked in finance for over a decade, was personally recruited to the software giant by founder Larry Ellison in 1999 and replaced him in the top job in 2014. She's seen what fame and fortune bring, and she's not impressed, Ellison once told Forbes. Most of her stake in Oracle has come from stock options. LeBron James, net worth $1.3 billion. The NBA great enters his 23rd season, set to pull in some $53 million in game checks from the Los Angeles Lakers and upward of $130 million factoring in his endorsement deals with the likes of Nike and Amazon. Then there's his investment portfolio, including production company Spring Hill, which he recently merged with the production outfit of British TV producer Ben Winston and former late-night host James Corden, plus an estimated 1% stake in Fenway Sports Group, owner of the MLB's Boston Red Sox, the NHL's Pittsburgh Penguins, and the Premier League's Liverpool FC. He's $100 million richer this year, but the poorest member of the Forbes 400 is still worth nearly three LeBrons. Fred Smith, net worth $5.3 billion, died in June at age 80. Smith came up with the idea for FedEx in 1965, arguing in a Yale economics paper that passenger jets could never handle all the world's shipments. Legend has it he got a C. But in 1973, after graduation and after 4 years as a Marine in Vietnam, earning two Purple Hearts, Smith launched FedEx anyway. It lost $29 million in its first 26 months, leading Smith to fly to Vegas and gamble the company's last $5,000, winning $27,000 at blackjack to help keep it afloat. The all-freight airline eventually revolutionized parcel delivery and was worth more than $50 billion when Smith retired as CEO in 2022. The House Ruthless Built, from March 26, 1984. 4 years before his death in 2020, Jack Welch wrote a post on LinkedIn titled, "Why I Love Micromanaging and You Should Too," a nod to his domineering 20-year reign over GE. 3 years into his tenure, Forbes spoke to Welch for a March 1984 cover story when the then 48-year-old CEO was still strengthening his iron grip on every part of the company. In earlier years, Jack Welch earned the nickname Neutron Jack, as in a neutron bomb. That's because it was said that after he went through a plant, the building was still there, but the people weren't. At the time, GE had $27 billion in sales, about $86 billion today, selling everything from jet engines to refrigerators. Welch pioneered the so-called rank and yank approach to HR, in which each year all GE employees were measured against their peers. The bottom 10% were unceremoniously fired. Without such actions, Welch told us, over the years you drag the whole business down, parceling out to the weak instead of infusing a winning attitude in the whole. Once lauded, Welch's management style has fallen out of favor. In 2024, an over-leveraged General Electric broke into three separate companies, marking the end of a 132-year-old American icon.